You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Texas, which is the second largest state in the United States, boasts a growing economy, a booming population, a major oil industry, and it's been home to a number of presidents. All of those factors combined have given Texas a strong sense of political power. In her latest, her sixth book, As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda, Gail Collins argues that Texas has been setting the political agenda in America over the last three decades. It's just been released in a paperback edition by Liverite with an added chapter, and I'm pleased that it brings Gail Collins back to our show. Hi.
Good to be here.
Now, Ted Cruz has replaced Kay Bailey Hutchinson as one of Texas's senators. That happened since the hardcover edition of your book was released. She was generally regarded as a moderate. Doesn't his election by a wide margin, he defeated Paul Sadler, his Democratic opponent, with a 56-41% margin, suggest that he's pretty popular in Texas right now?
Yeah, well, he... It's so interesting. I thought when the election came and Texas was on the losing side that there was going to be kind of a hiatus in my Texas taking over the world. But one way or the other, Texas is moving forward in a way that's going to have such a profound impact on everybody else. Either Ted Cruz and the right wing are going to further control the Republican Party in Texas. We're seeing right now John Cornyn, who's the other senator there, who was a perfectly normal conservative Republican senator until recently, is suddenly taking lots of really hard right positions, and everyone feels it's because he's afraid that he's going to be primaried from the right by someone in the Cruz pantheon there. And at the same time, the Democrats are looking with great excitement toward Texas because of the humongous Hispanic population, which will be they're already a majority-minority state, and they'll be a majority-Hispanic state in a decade or so.
Well, Ted Cruz is Hispanic, but he was born in Calgary, Canada. So is he seen more as a Canadian or as a Hispanic in Texas?
Well, that's going to be so interesting to see. I mean, we're getting so deep right now into the political importance of the Hispanic vote. We don't know really whether that's one vote or a fragmented vote. We don't really know whether Cuban-American politicians are going to have a particular appeal to Mexican-American voters, for instance. And we don't know a lot of Democratic operatives are sure that the real reason that the Hispanic population has been so inclined to vote Democratic over the last couple of elections is not just immigration, but because of health care. The Hispanic population is among the most desperately in need of health care. Texas is, I think, the worst state in the union when it comes to lack of health care coverage. So if it's health care, the Republicans are doomed. If it turns out to be immigration and a culturally conservative Cuban-American guy can appeal to Spanish-speaking voters in Texas, then maybe not.
Well, it's a majority-minority state, and yet it remains red. Is that because of redistricting?
It is partly because of redistricting. The redistricting has been particularly outrageous in Texas. Almost all of its growth has come from its Hispanic and other minority populations, and all the districts the new districts that were added in Texas were added on, were all intended for Anglo politicians. So it's been a problem. But the big problem there is lack of voting, which is universal. There's no ethnic group that votes as heavily in Texas as they do in other parts of the country. But it's particularly bad with the Hispanic population. So there are already Democratic operatives who have moved out of Ohio and the other places where they were working during the election and are looking to resettle down in Texas and see what they can do about really gearing up for the next election cycle.
Well, as you point out in the book, Ted Cruz said that there was a UN plot to destroy our golf courses, and yet that didn't hurt him.
That was my favorite Ted Cruz story.
But that didn't hurt him. Now he doesn't seem to be very popular with many members of his own party, even when they felt he was particularly overly aggressive in the Chuck Hagel hearings. So would that aggressive approach play well in Texas?
Nobody actually in the outside world cares whether or not their senator is popular in Washington. They might think they do, but they don't really. And no baby new junior senator who's been there for about 4 weeks is going to be popular if he keeps making long speeches in the caucus meetings about what everybody else is supposed to do if they're going to be right. So he's not popular there, but that doesn't have much of an impact on home. We don't know. I mean, he was elected. There was a perfectly normal established but Republican who was the lieutenant governor who was supposed to get that nomination. And then the Tea Party people came out again. The election was, I forget, at some ridiculous point, like in the middle of August or something, when nobody voted. And it was just a perfect recipe for this kind of thing. You take an election, make it a very obscure election with no other candidates at a time when nobody's going to be paying any attention, and you're the right wing people who really care about it are going to go out and vote, and nobody else will.
Now, let's get back to your subtitle, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. How much of the national agenda has been the result of the influence of Texas?
Well, I was thinking about that, you know, after when Rick Perry started his secession talk as the Tea Party was being born, and you know, even after this last election, Texas was much secession talk coming out of Texas after Obama was reelected. But when Perry was doing it, I sort of looked back and I thought, why are these people so angry? They've been running the country for the past 30 years. And if you look back on the big things that have happened in America, the savings and loan crisis, for instance, was really in great part about the decision by the federal government to follow the Texas model for regulating savings and loans, which it liked because the savings and loans in Texas seemed to be doing so well. The reason they were was because they were all cooking the books, and it led to huge disaster both nationally and in Texas. If you look at bank deregulation, there are billions of people's fingers in the pie, but I argued that the biggest thumb of all was Senator Graham of Texas, who was the head of the banking committee.
And then Enron was based in Texas.
And then Enron was based in Texas, and that whole crisis was totally, all of the crises over electricity brownouts in California, you could arguably trace back to things that were going on in Texas. If you move further, of course, every ground war since Vietnam that we've been fought in has been started by a president from Texas, although there's only a couple of those guys, so maybe that's not fair. And Vietnam, too. You had Lyndon Johnson. So there's a lot of war stuff going on there, and No Child Left Behind. Everything that's going on now with education in America came out of George W. Bush's experiences with the Texas school system and the reforms that were happening in Texas. So you just sort of add all this stuff up, and it's very clear that just so much of what we're doing now is a reaction to things that were thought up in Texas. And here we are today, but Texas is the one that's angry.
My guest is Gail Collins. Her latest book, now available in paperback, As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. Well, you mentioned all the secession talk. Doesn't Texas celebrate its own Independence Day? Does that, the fact that it was once a republic, play a role in that talk?
It's a huge thing down there. I have never met anyone from Texas who did not, as a school child, go on a pilgrimage to the Alamo. They do celebrate Independence Day. It's a Texas holiday. The vision of all that stuff, Sanjus, whenever I went down for a tour, somebody would always get up and start yelling at me about the Battle of San Jacinto. I mean, it's stuff that nobody else in the world thinks about, but it's very important there, and it's what interests me so much is that Texas spirit that's celebrated there, the idea that you're going to stand up for your principles even if they're kind of crazy, and you're just going to do what you think is the right thing to do even if it causes total chaos. If you look at Lyndon Johnson, And he's a great example of kind of that feeling, that the better or worst of that feeling. I think the Civil Rights Act, you could argue, and Lyndon Johnson knew that was going to be disaster short-term for the Democratic Party, but he marched ahead and did it. And the war in Vietnam. I mean, he marched ahead even though it was a terrible idea. There's a very Alamo kind of thing about the way everybody wound up staying in Vietnam and pursuing it. So it's very big in Texas. And I was, you know, I come from Ohio, and which is a large state, and we have had many presidents who have come from Ohio, but we did not celebrate Ohio independence. Well, there was no Ohio Independence Day, but we did not know what the state flag looked like. You could have put the Ohio state flag, you know, on top of any kid in school, and they would never have any idea what it was. The kids in Texas salute the Texas state flag every day. They salute the Texas state flag in the state legislature. The sense that you are of Texas is really very unique. It's much more intense than it is in your average state, certainly in Ohio.
Well, there's an urban-rural divide in many states, but in Texas, you call it the law of empty spaces and crowded spaces.
Yeah, I've come to feel very strongly that the big political divide in this country always has been between the empty places and the crowded places. Not just in Texas, and I like that because it makes sense. If you live in a crowded place like New York City, you see every day all the useful things that government is doing for you. And you walk down the street, and there are policemen, and there's a subway, and there's 1,000 things that have to do with government. So you tend to be very positive about the idea of government. If you live in an empty place, you know, what's the point? You don't see anything. If a burglar breaks in, you're going to get your rifle out and shoot at him. The police aren't going to come. And there's nobody else around. It's all about you. So it makes sense. The interesting thing about Texas and the interesting thing about our political divide right now is that it's more theoretical. It's more in your mind. You have people who are living in 1,000-unit condos in Florida that are subsidized by the federal government, who are sure that if only they could get government off their back, they could be really, really, really happy. In Texas, most people live in metropolitan areas. If you look at Houston, you look at Dallas, then most people live in these very humongous metropolitan areas, but it still feels like an empty place because it takes so much time to get from one place to another, and there's so much empty space in between. You do have that feeling, even if you're living in Houston, that you're kind of in an empty place.
Well, Houston is one of the first major cities to elect an openly gay mayor. Almost all the major cities in Texas voted for President Obama in 2012.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at Austin, I mean, Austin is one of the most liberal cities you'll ever run into anywhere.
And didn't they propose some people in Austin seceding from Texas? Was that just a joke?
Yeah, when there was that great Texas secession movement after Obama was reelected, and then there was a movement then started in Austin to say that if Texas seceded, then Austin would be allowed to secede from Texas. That was their theory. But it is, yeah, the urban areas are very urban. But if you live in, say, the suburbs of Houston, those suburbs go on for 100,000 miles, I swear, and you can be driving for 2 hours to get to work. There's nothing but highways all around you, and it's easy to imagine that although you're surrounded by cars everywhere you go, that it's kind of an empty place.
Well, Houston is a kind of a magnet city. Don't a lot of out-of-state people live in Houston?
Yeah, if you look at, I can't remember the numbers now, but I was talking to a professor down there who said that if you look at the population over 60, it's by a large majority white Anglo. But if you look at the population under 35, it's a minority population. It's Hispanic, it's African American, it's to a great degree now Asian, tiny proportion of Anglo kids, comparatively speaking. So it's a whole different world coming up, as it is in so many other places, and that's another reason you really want to see what's going to happen to Texas over the next 10 or 15 years.
Well, what is the job market like in Texas compared with states like California and New York? How accurate was Rick Perry's ad inviting Californians to move to Texas?
He loves doing that. You know, I mean, he's
if he could only remember the third thing, he'd be okay.
You're right. He could be president right now. Our whole world would be unique and different. I don't think so, but still, it's yeah. I mean, it's a good place to go to get a high tech job in some parts of the state. Interestingly, Texas does not educate enough college students to fill the jobs that it has. So it basically is relying on states like California and Illinois and New York to produce these college students, which it will then use in its high-tech industry. Most of a humongous number of the jobs in Texas, however, are low-paid jobs with no benefits, with very little protection for, say, work or disability if you're injured on the job. Very little unionization. It's a very tough place to be poor in, to be a working poor person in. It couldn't be tougher, really.
My guest is Gail Collins, who writes a very popular op-ed column in the New York Times twice a week, at least when it appears. Her sixth book is As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. It is published by Liberite. And we're going to take a little break, and we'll come back with more, Gail. We'll get specific about Texas in the second part of this conversation. So stay with us. We're back with Gail Collins, the best-selling author of When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. She is also a national op-ed columnist for the New York Times and the author of As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. It has just been released in a new paperback edition from Liberate, updated with a new chapter. Do you think, Gail, that most Americans are aware of how much political influence Texas wields?
It's interesting. When I went around the country, when I did the book tour on the hardcover version, I thought people in Texas would be very angry at me, and that people around the rest of the country would be interested. But people around the rest of the country were very angry at the idea that Texas was the most important state, particularly California. People in California did not like that idea at all. So there's some resistance to the whole idea. And there is a hostility toward Texans that I found a little bit surprising, since I do find Texans on the personal level to be extremely lovely people. But there's really, in many parts of the country, an enormous anti-Texas sort of thing going on right now.
Has your newspaper, the New York Times, considered the influence of Texas a major national story?
Oh, yeah. Well, we have an entire sort of operation in Texas that we've been working with the Texas Tribune for several years now. The Texas Tribune is a nonprofit organization that covers state politics there. And we run lots and lots of Texas Tribune stories all the time on the web. And, of course, we have our own reporters in Texas. So I would say we have not ignored Texas at all here at the paper.
Texas may have influenced the national agenda in recent decades, but is that likely to hold true for the future?
Well, you know, it depends on which way it goes. I could see two formulations here, sort of Texas leading the way as the Republican Party breaks off into something that's increasingly irrelevant every place except the Deep South and the Great Plains, or Texas turning in an entire new direction and becoming a purple state with a large, actively voting Hispanic majority. Either way, that transforms the next scene for American politics.
You say that Texas is creating 10% of the future workforce of America. Seems to me to be an ominous omen, or perhaps a positive omen. But how is that measured? And who is that future workforce?
Well, you know, the important thing about, I was sort of fascinated with the whole states' rights thing and how, you know, and I don't think most Americans would argue that states have individual characteristics and that there are certain things you want states to be regulating on their own, as long as they don't slosh over and affect all the other states. I've come to the point where I'm never again going to attempt to argue with people in some place like Texas about gun control in Texas. I mean, they're going to work their own rules, whatever they are.
Have they set the agenda for the rest of the country, or are they just part of that agenda?
They sell a lot of guns there. If you are, in particularly for Mexico, which was not at the center of our discussion here, but many, many, many crimes in Mexico are committed with guns bought in Texas. Many crimes in California are concealed. It's very hard to buy a gun in California, as it is in New York City, but many of the crimes in California are committed with guns that were bought in Texas. So when it comes to the purchase of guns, the sale of guns, what kind of guns are sold, and how easy it is to get them, that's national. Once you get past that, when it comes to whether or not you can wear a gun, a concealed weapon, when you go to a bar, I'm not going to fight with Texas about that one. We'll make our rules and we'll let them make theirs.
Now, you mentioned No Child Left Behind earlier. That was developed when George Bush was the governor of Texas?
The Texas school reforms, actually, it is an interesting story. It started in the 1970s. Before then, Texas's schools were really abysmal. Very few people, I think, in Texas would argue that they were not really abysmal going into the 70s. And at that point, reform started, and they raised more money through taxes and spent it on the schools, which some people might argue was the thing they did right. They also, to appease particularly the business interests, they started doing accountability reforms, which involved a lot of testing. Now, whether you think it was the tests or the more resources that made the schools get better in Texas is a really good indication of where you're going to come down on a lot of other issues that have come forth out of that.
Well, you say it was paid for by taxes. Yes. Taxes are very low in Texas, aren't
taxes
they?
Taxes are. This was one of the very few times in Texas when you got a series of them, because there were also a series of Texas State Supreme Court decisions about the financing of schools, because the schools in poor neighborhoods were so horrifically much lower in quality than the schools in the really good neighborhoods they're still litigating this. It's been going on forever, and it goes on again even today. But because of some of those court rulings, they again had to raise taxes and bring in some more money. This was a long time ago. I mean, we're talking Ann Richards was the last governor that this happened under, really. But then, you know, when George W. Bush came in, he was very interested in education. The idea of improving education for poorer kids was something that did interest him. He got very into the idea of accountability and testing and accountability. And when he brought his ideas to Washington, there was an agreement in theory that you would do a lot of the testing that he was so interested in to get federal funding, but you would also have a lot more federal funding going into the states. And that second part really broke down. You didn't get nearly as much of that. But I can't say the guy who was doing most of the negotiating with Congress for the White House then went on to become a lobbyist for Pearson, which is the largest private test writer in the entire world at this point in time. So a lot of the stuff that came out of that, I'd argue anyway, that there were, you know, very good reforms as far as more concern about education, but also a lot of stuff, not just about testing, but about privatization, about bringing the profit-making sector into the world of public education, that comes right out of that Texas experience.
Now, a lot has been made about the fact that Texas influences the quality of textbooks on a national level. But doesn't California also have a textbook approval system? Why doesn't it have as much of an impact as Texas?
There are different systems. For one thing, the California system, the experts always tell me, is so deeply California that nobody outside California is going to want to use a book that was written to appease the California system of writing textbooks. The other thing is that until very recently, Texas had a very short list of two or three textbooks that it would pay for each grade, each subject matter. So the mass appeal of this, you could then, if you were another state, your textbook became much cheaper if it was the Texas textbook.
Even though people pointed out there were inaccuracies in the Texas textbooks?
The worst thing to me that happened, and there were a lot of attempts by the Texas Board of Education, which is, again, one of these things that's elected in a weird election where very few people go to the polls, where the right wing is very active. A lot of people on that board tried to get rid of the teaching of evolution. There was one woman on the board for a long time who was on the record as saying public schools were the tool of Satan. I don't know how that worked out every day, but you had folks like that on there. To me, the biggest outcome of all that was not so much the errors as the fact that the textbooks often became totally incoherent. Really, really hard to read because you had the textbook publishers looking over their shoulders so much, trying not to make anybody unhappy in Texas, and of course other states too, but Texas was the biggest player, so that you got very kind of bland and garbled language that had a hard time coming to a point because of the terror that if it came to a point, then somebody wouldn't like the point it came to. So I think you could argue the textbooks in this country became much, much harder for kids to get through, thanks to Texas.
They also address issues like safe sex and sex practices, and you had a recent
practices are wonderful.
You had a recent op-ed column, "The Woes of Roe." Where does Texas stand on abortion rights these days?
Oh, Texas is way in the vanguard when it comes to driving Planned Parenthood out of the state, making women have sonograms before they get everything that you can do to make things impossible, particularly for poor women who need to get an abortion. They've already done. They've also they're sort of famous for their sex education programs in the public school systems. There was a group called the Texas Freedom Network a few years back who sponsored a study of what it was that was actually being taught in the sex education classes. And very few of them at that point were teaching anything that really had to do with sex education. There was a lot of emphasis on how condoms didn't work, but not much else about condoms. The only information you were getting in a lot of these schools was how condoms don't work.
So what is teen pregnancy rates like in Texas?
Humongous. They're very, very high. And of course, these are also kids that wind up dropping out of school, and all the problems that come with teen pregnancy followed forth with that. There was one school that had an interview that they played for the kids in which this kid is talking to a minister and asking, what will happen if I have sex before I'm married? And the minister says, well, you'll have to be prepared to die. This reminds me of what happened in my Catholic school back in the 1950s. There was a real strong sentiment of, sex equals death, And that condoms don't work. You can't use condoms, and the whole point is to save yourself for marriage. And if kids don't save themselves for marriage, then they know nothing. All the kids that do wind up in Texas is not superior to the rest of the country when it comes to the rate at which kids have sex while they're in high school. Those kids get many parts of the state, no information whatsoever about what to do.
Yeah, we have very little time, and there are a number of things I wanted to touch on, so I'm going to let
you
choose.
But we've been talking about sex. That's
Yeah, I love it. environmental policy, foreign policy, the Texas miracle, the Enterprise Fund. Where do you want to go now?
Oh, wow. The Enterprise Fund is interesting to me in that, you know, this was the Texas plan to bring more jobs to Texas by basically bribing companies to come, which I don't understand why that's not unconstitutional, to use public money that are gotten from taxpayers to bribe companies to come to your state, and then another state can come in and try to bribe them back. It's not at all clear that it's worked one bit. You know, investigative reporters have gone to some of the places that were allegedly started by these, they're mostly Rick Perry's initiatives, and found, you know, empty buildings and you know, or maybe one accountant there trying to figure out ways to count jobs that already existed before as part of the state. So,
well, where did they get the money for the fund?
Oh, it's from state money, the Enterprise Institute. And many movie makers complained to me that, you know, this part of the, there was a particular fund for encouraging people to make movies in Texas, and that it was actually used to shoot commercials in Texas by people who would have shot them anyway. But that was a minor grievance, I guess, in the great scheme of things. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens next in Texas. There's a new generation. Everybody knows about them now. I think the Castro brothers, who are, it's so very Texan. The new star politician is twins. There's two of them, and one of them is now a congressman. One of them is the mayor of San Antonio, and they're both looked at as, you know, potential statewide candidates. Maybe both together, who can say? But on the other side, George Bush, the new little Bush, is being groomed. He's a Texan and is being groomed to run is for something. We're not quite sure what in the next round.
So it'd be like the Kennedys, a fourth generation?
Yeah, Bushes of many generations and Castros that are all identical. It's a very Texas way to run things. I have to say that their politics is absolutely fascinating.
Well, what about foreign policy? I know Halliburton is largely based in Texas. Does it have much of an impact on what goes on in Washington?
It did certainly when oil was the central question. I think that goes all the way back to Lyndon Johnson.
Well, isn't oil still big in Texas? Doesn't that affect its approach to the environment?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And totally, the environment, you know, there's always been a large argument in Texas that federal government's got no right to come in and mess with our laws. But the amount of carbon, in particular carbon being spewed into the air in Texas is the highest in the country. They're doing, again, it's all a matter of whether or not you think things slosh over across state lines. The carbon sloshes over across state lines. Kids that are not educated and go into the workforce don't all stay in Texas. They go other places. People who did not get health care, do not get health treatment, and have chronic diseases do not all stay in Texas. They go over to other states, and guns that are bought in Texas do not all stay in Texas. They go over to other states. So I think that the interesting thing, or one of the interesting things about Texas, is trying to make that division between this humongous place, which, God bless them, if they want to run their own things and it doesn't leech over into the rest of us, let them have at it. But most things do. Education does. Health care does. Gun sales do, energy rules, energy laws, oil depreciation taxes, allowances, all that stuff sloshes right over to the rest of us.
Why do you think the Justice Department dropped its case against Joe Arpaio and his practices?
I don't know. It's a very good question, but I do not know the answer.
Yeah, it's my sense from what you've been saying that that Washington is very aware of how things play in Texas. Joe Arpaio is in what?
Yeah.
He's
in Arizona.
Arizona, next state. But we've seen some of
about Texas, by the way. I'm glad you mentioned Arizona. The Texans hysterically are not nuts on the subject of immigration in the way that some parts of Arizona, for instance, are. You know, when Rick Perry was running for president, you know, and suddenly Mitt Romney started yelling at him about the fact that children who are brought here illegally as children could get state rates when they went to state colleges, and Perry was just stunned because that was what the business community wanted in Texas. It wasn't something that was regarded as unusual or insane. Texas is comfortable with its sort of dual heritage as an Anglo and Hispanic culture. And it's sad when you get to these points where people so desperately try to gear it up again and make everybody crazy, because that's the one place where Texas really could lead well, I think, if they took their minds to it.
After writing for New York Newsday and the New York Daily News, Gail Collins joined the New York Times in 1995 as a member of its editorial board. In 2001, she became the first woman ever appointed editor of the Times editorial board. But she gave that up to write a popular op-ed column beginning in 2007. And we're happy to see you twice a week. She also has written 6 books, pretty much all of them bestsellers. The latest, As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda, has been updated with a new chapter for the paperback edition just out from LibWrite. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Great to be here.